KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Game Change is the best-selling story of the 2008 presidential election that was turned into an HBO movie. The authors, Mark Halperin and John Halliman, have a new book out called Double Down, Game Change 2012. In it, they apply their political knowledge to the 2012 election. They go beyond the headlines to offer an account of a hard-fought campaign on both sides. They spoke at the First Presbyterian Church on November 12, 2013, in an event sponsored by Town Hall. The talk was moderated by University of Washington Professor David Domke.
Let me start with this question, gentlemen. 53 years ago, Teddy White's book, Making of the President, was published. It was seen as a genre creator, understanding how a president gets elected. What are we going to be saying 50 years from now about your two books?
That's my equivalent of taking a lifeline. You.
Let me just expand on that as you think.
That's a nice, easy question to start with there. Thanks for like easing into this interview.
I'm in a church. I'm feeling some pressure here, okay? What's the goal of the two books? And this one, is it a different goal than the first book or not?
That's better. That's a much easier question. First of all, we're really grateful to be here. Happy to be here. Thank you guys all for coming out. We've been... This is the very beginning, apart from last week, where we started out in New York and Washington, D.C. We're starting on a nationwide ramble that begins here in a great book-buying city, in a fabulous, somewhat intimidating arena. The answer to the question, the real answer, is that we have done exactly the same thing in the two books. And Mark and I have been doing political journalism for more than two decades each. And we're interested in policy, and we're interested in data and strategy and strategists and polling and pollsters, and we write about all that stuff in our magazine work. But with both these books, what we've really tried to be focused on is the high human drama of running for president. And so in the first book and in this book, we've tried to do the same thing, which is to focus on the candidates and their spouses and their families and try to explain what it is like to go through the process of running for president, which is an extraordinarily intense and difficult and life-changing event where people's strengths and weaknesses and flaws are put under intense pressure, and the ones, people who respond, they are changed by the process, they adapt to the process, and in the end, those strengths and weaknesses and flaws all come out one way or the other, and the ones who adapt the best are the ones who do the best. But that is really what we've been mostly focused on, is the human element throughout both books.
Okay, the human element. Is there a... And is that revealed in the words that people tell you, the stories they tell you? Is it revealed in your own reporting? What's the core evidence for the book? Is it something you've seen or what people have told you?
Thank you all for coming. As John said, really honored to be here tonight. You know, we did 500 interviews for this book, which is 200 more than we did for the last interview. And these aren't short interviews. These are often several hours long. We don't really have the luxury. Most journalists today don't have the luxury of doing interviews like that for daily work or weekly work or even a tweet. We don't always report out our tweets, you'll be surprised to hear, sometimes just off the top of our head. This is a much different project than anything else we do and most journalists do today on almost any topic, to be able to... report out, if you're writing about a meeting with seven people, to talk to all seven people and to talk to some of them more than once in order to make sure that everything's accurate. And we hear stories, and sometimes we'll hear a story in an interview and we'll know right away, that's going in the book. We have an acronym we use, SITB, which stands for straight in the book. As somebody tells us something, we know that's going to end up in the book in one form or another after we've reported it out. And then there are other stories where we feel that way, and they don't end up in the book. Because over the course of time, we sift through everything. We got a simple rule, a series of simple rules we use to do this. And one of them seems kind of stupid, but not every author adheres to it, which is we only include things that we think are interesting. We're not writing a comprehensive history of every primary and every caucus. But what is in the book is the outgrowth of what we like to think of as almost oral histories the interviews that we do. They're not off, they're almost never confrontational. We both are constantly good cop in these interviews, except on occasion, as is necessitated in a few instances. But for the most part, what you see in the book is the outgrowth of reading a lot of transcripts, thinking about what people tell us, and then doubling back to try to make sure that the facts are right and we're telling the stories in the most interesting way we can.
In the New Republic, I wrote an interesting piece about you guys getting interviews and getting people to talk to you. And I want to ask a couple questions about the incredible anecdotes you get from people. But I just want to check one thing that I think it said in there. When you did all of the interviews that come into the book, are those done post-election, all of the interviews? Or is that material you've gathered during the course of many months of being on the campaign trail and being around? So is it a little bit of both? Is it mostly one or the other?
It's a little bit of both. This book we started working on in the middle of 2010. So we really did it for the better part of 3 years. And we both have day jobs in both magazines and in television. We try to do coverage. We try to be doing stuff for the book and gathering string for the book as we go. Obviously, in terms of our travel, going to public events and taking notes on those things that we're seeing candidates perform in Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina or wherever. And then we also do some number of book interviews along the way, principally after, for instance, like last in the summer of 2012, after the Republican nomination fight was over, we spent a lot of time with candidates candidates and their staffs who had lost. So it was relatively fresh. They could remember what had happened in the nomination fight. And we had some time over the summer. But the vast bulk of the interviews that we do are after Election Day. And the interviews that we do prior to Election Day are really strictly cordoned off from our magazine and television work. So we say to people, this is for the book. It's embargoed until after the election. So we're going to have a conversation that's on that basis, and that's how those conversations take place. And then the other conversations that we have after Election Day, obviously, are taking place after Election Day. Again, trying to get the benefit of doing things as soon after Election Day as possible, so memories are fresh. But people do certainly feel freer to talk to us after Election Day when the competition is over. But we think it's really important in terms of history, because one of the things we've discovered in doing the last two books is that people's memories are horrible. And, you know, we've had multiple instances of interviews where we talked to a source in June of 2012, and then we talked to them again in December of 2012, and we say to them, well, we've heard the following thing happen, and the source will say, well, that never happened. I don't know where you would have heard that. And we say, well, you told us that 6 months ago. And, oh, now I remember. That's right. It did happen. You know, the campaigns move at such a pace, and the reason it's valuable is that, you know, in a lot of campaigns, people don't write things down. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But the truth is, a lot of the things that we are able to put in the book are things that if we weren't doing these interviews either in the middle of the campaign or immediately thereafter, they would genuinely just be lost to history, because people's memories are so frail and so fleeting that we feel like, you know, if you're thinking about these books as a first draft of history, and that's at best all they are because we're doing them so soon, it really is valuable to get to people this soon, because a lot of this stuff would just disappear if we didn't talk to people as soon after the campaign as we do.
When an email from you two guys shows up in an inbox of a potential person you want to talk to, or a phone call or text, what's the dominant reaction? Have you found that most people are feeling
unbridled glee?
Yeah, okay.
Snoopy dance. They do a little dance.
They do a little dance? Okay, that's good. Is it most people say, God, I really do want to just kind of dish. I do want to just talk, because it's the nature of the kind of animals that you're talking to.
You know, we did over 500 interviews, as we said. Fewer than a dozen people said no to us. And most of those were relatively small players in the drama. People like to share their stories. From almost everybody we interviewed, this was one of the most intense emotional professional experiences they ever had. And we've, as was suggested before, we've done this for a long time. So we're dealing almost exclusively with people who aren't strangers to us. Over time, if you're a reporter who is honest and straightforward with your sources, then you build up a reputation for integrity. And people know, having gone through the interviews, again, we interviewed a lot of people multiple times, these aren't confrontational. These are us looking to get the best stories to tell the story of what happened in the clearest and most compelling way. Most of the candidates told their teams to cooperate with us. So in the case, for instance, of the two main campaigns, the president's campaign and Governor Romney's campaign, we received extensive cooperation because sort of the word was out, it was okay to participate. So when they got those emails, generally, they just a matter of scheduling on people's busy schedules.
Plus, we buy them a lot of drinks, and people generally like to be fed and lubricated. So it's a general matter in life, not just in journalism.
I don't think I'm giving away too much. You stop me if you don't want me to say this, but all the emails begin with the phrase, "Do you like pina coladas?"
That's the key right there.
It's an icebreaker.
Right? Okay. You guys hear, you have people tell you things that you break news with your books. You tell us things that we did not get from the blogs and the Twitter feeds and so on. How do you separate that from the daily work you do? Do you have contracts with your news organizations or something that allow you to bracket off pieces? How does that work?
Well, I mean, the truth is, as I said before, like the vast majority of the interviews we do are after the election, and so we've gone on book leave for most of the cases, so it's not really that big a problem. Both of our employers know that we're doing these books, and you know, we are, I would say, you know, whatever you think of the quality of the work that we do in real time, our bosses seem to be happy at least with the quantity of the work we do. We're pretty prolific in terms of the stuff we do both on TV and on in our magazine, so... no one's kind of complaining about not getting good material from us and ample material from us as we're going along. But again, it's kind of the crucial thing is that we're doing a lot of it after Election Day, where we're, you know, off, you know, really just focused exclusively on the book.
The other element of it is all these interviews, as John suggested before, are embargoed till after the election, even the ones we do before the election. And then all the interviews are embargoed for the book. And so our employers know that we wouldn't be getting that information. People wouldn't be giving us those scoops if they thought it was going to appear in any other form at any other time, except a year after the election when the book comes out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you ever get any information during the campaign that you feel could make a difference in the electorate's decision making that you're just bound to not share, though, because of the agreements you've reached? That I'm not sure. Information about a Chris Christie file, something like that, where it's useful for it just to be something that I as a voter might really want to know, but I'm not going to hear until a year after the election.
Well, voters have you know, interesting tastes and in what they consider interesting. You know, there have been times when we've discovered the dietary habits of candidates in real time, and you might be very concerned about a candidate's love for peanut brittle, but you know, so it's hard to know what any given voter, you know, considers important. You know, we have, as Mark said, you know, we have the most important thing to us always is our relationships with our sources, and not making a representation to a source about the terms of a conversation and then violating those terms. So once you promise someone that you are not going to reveal something they've said until after a certain time, it makes it pretty easy not to be tempted to reveal that, given that you've made a promise to someone that you won't.
Mark Halperin and John Halliman, the authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012. They spoke at the First Presbyterian Church on November 12, 2013, in an event sponsored by Town Hall. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of their talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. 2008 was a landmark election year for many reasons, but what about 2012? Mark Halperin and John Halliman are the authors of a new book about the 2012 election called Double Down. They spoke at the First Presbyterian Church on November 12th in an event sponsored by Town Hall. The talk was moderated by University of Washington Professor David Domke.
Was there a specific moment in your working relationship where, on the first book, on Game Change, where you said, hell yeah, we got to write a book? Like a moment where you just said, this needs a book.
There was a very specific moment. We'd never written anything together, but we were coming back from an event that Senator McCain was doing in Annapolis. This was shortly after he became the de facto Republican nominee in the spring of 2008. And he went on something they called a biography tour to try to kind of reintroduce himself to the country after he'd been pretty battered in winning the Republican nomination. He was going to go all around the country to places that he'd been part of big parts of his life. So where he served in Alabama when he was in the Navy, and also the Naval Academy. And so John and I went to an event in Annapolis. It was billed as Senator McCain giving a speech on honor and duty and service, and it said it was going to be at the football stadium in Annapolis. We thought it would be a huge event. We envisioned a stage in the center of the football field, thousands of screaming midshipmen behind him. And when we got there, we found something quite different. It wasn't the football stadium, but it was on the concourse. The backdrop was the empty stadium. There were about 40 people in the audience. It was an incredibly windy day. Senator McCain was, as he sometimes was, just maybe a little bit grumpy. And the speech was so disjointed and his delivery so desolatory that at one point, one of the pages of his text flew away, and he just skipped it and went from page 9 to page 11, and no one noticed because it wasn't any less disjointed than the rest of his remarks. So we drove back to Washington after that event and just talked about the bathos and the richness of the humanity of John McCain at this point, going this presumably triumphant return, or supposedly triumphant return back there. And it was something short of that. We just started talking about the campaign and how dramatic and exciting it had been. And that conversation, which we had sitting sort of in the shadows of the Capitol in front of the C-SPAN studios where I was headed in to do an interview, animated not only the first book, but the way we've done the second one as well, with a focus on just a few things. One is try to answer the big unanswered questions of the campaign. At that point, we thought, well, you know, is anybody going to ever answer the question of what was Bill Clinton's role in his wife's campaign and how did it develop? Or what made Barack Obama think he could run for president and win? Series of other questions that we had then and developed later on, like why did John McCain pick Sarah Palin as his running mate? Something we didn't feel had adequately explained.
Do you have an answer to that now?
Even in this church, I do not. At least not fully. Anyway, that was one animating principle. Another was to kind of think about this in a novelistic way, not lower our journalistic standards at all, but to say, to sort of conceive of it as big dramatic scenes, almost cinematic scenes that would be susceptible to or lend themselves to being made part of a movie, say, in case someone wanted to make a movie about our book. And then finally, again, as John said earlier, just kind of this relentless focus, not on tactics and strategy and polling and what a lot of coverage is about, including a lot of our daily coverage and weekly coverage, but rather on that high human drama involving what makes someone run, what's it like to run, and to answer the question in almost every instance, and if you read either of the books, you'll see this really animates it. What are the challenges that a person is facing at that time, a candidate or someone else in the book? How do they feel about the challenge, and what do they do about it? And all those things we came up with either in that conversation or shortly thereafter, and that made us feel confident that there was a possibility, at least, we could write a book that would come out a year or so after the election that people would still be interested in.
In Game Change, my assessment would be the two high epic human moments are Hillary Clinton's dealing with the loss of her campaign and John McCain's selection of Sarah Palin. Like, that was the pieces where there was just human psychology and there was stories and all of this. Is there a particular piece I've read in terms of the punditry about this book, maybe the high human drama moment is the debates in this. Would you say that is the case from your position as authors, or for some people who might want to buy the book or have read the book, what are the highest human moments, the apex, the climactic moments of this book?
Can I just ask you to clarify what you mean by might want to buy the book?
Okay.
I was actually just going to say, it sounds like you're really just begging for spoilers here.
Just to cue us into a couple stories. You don't have to reveal the stories, though.
You named one of them, and there are several in the book, but you know, we've both been covering Barack Obama for a pretty long time now, and I've known him since we were both graduate students at Harvard in 1988, so that's a pretty long time. And I think we, in the course of writing, answering, one of the things we try to do in these books also is to, you know, look at big public events that everyone fixates on when they happen and then have questions about, and then we try to go back and say, well, this is what was really going on. And certainly in this campaign, for a lot of Democrats in particular, the president's poor performance in the first debate in Denver was a big question. What happened to Barack Obama in Denver? So we were obviously interested in that subject. And as we delved into that subject, we found ourselves drawn increasingly to another subject, which was, well, after that debate, Not just why did he perform poorly, but what did he do about it? As Mark suggested, challenges, how do you feel about them, what do you do about them? How did Barack Obama fix it? And that became a story, a thread that we started digging more into. And that led us to the second debate, which people have not written about very much at all, but the question of how the president came out of Denver, assuring all of his supporters and his colleagues and his staff that he was going to do well in the second debate. He knew he needed to do well in the second debate. The research that they had done suggested that in focus groups, people kind of forgave the president for the first debate. That kind of, you know, you would have focus group participants who'd say, well, I'm sure he wasn't feeling well that night, you know. But his team realized that if he performed poorly in the second debate, it would be a much bigger problem. And as the president reassured them, it'll all be fine, it'll all be fine, it'll all be fine. And then 48 hours before that second debate in New York, the president suffered in his practice sessions a kind of historic, epic performance failure. And he performed worse in this mock debate, a practice debate against John Kerry, who was standing in for Mitt Romney at this session. He performed worse than he performed in Denver and worse than he performed in any of the practice sessions leading up to Denver. And his team was so alarmed and so panicked that for really the first time in all of 2012, the top people around Barack Obama were saying, you know, in the middle of the night, less than 48 hours before this crucial debate, were saying, if he does that again, if he does what he did tonight on stage in New York two nights from now, he could lose the whole election. And what that led to was what they called the next morning an intervention, where four of the president's top aides, his chief of staff, his debate coach, and his two top political aides, sat down with the president and said, you know, Mr. President, something's wrong with you, and we need to understand what it is, and we don't know what's going on inside your head. And this is where I'll stop with the story, but in detail, because it's really an extraordinary thing to read. The president, for the next hour, spoke in a searching, introspective way about not just what was going wrong in that moment, but his discomfort with certain aspects of performance in politics, with the artificiality, the theatricalness of what he was expected to do in these debates, with his own absence of what he thought of as a fully robust agenda for his second term. And it was really, for all of the people in the room, a moment like they'd never experienced in politics before, where, you know, 2 weeks before Election Day, they were not talking about lines and zingers and strategy and tactics. They were talking about the president's kind of existential crisis about himself. And I think for anybody who's interested in Barack Obama and how he thinks about politics and how he thinks about performance and how he thinks about competition, it's a really revealing scene, and it was totally surprising to Mark and I to the story itself, all of these facts, which had not been reported before, but the things you learn about President Obama there were quite eye-opening to us and I think to a fair number of people who've read the book so far.
I agree that I found that portion of the book compelling. It's really, really compelling. It's tremendous reporting, tremendous writing. In about 5 minutes, we're going to open this up to questions for everybody to come up and to microphones. I just want you to, if you're thinking about questions, you get a chance to come up here in just a couple minutes. Let me just ask you maybe one, maybe two more questions here. How, slightly off the book, but it's related nonetheless, how much has the Twitter arena and the cable television news arena changed how politics is covered and journalism is reported from who people have been in the middle of doing that coverage? Can you speak firsthand about that change and, you know, how it shapes a book and what you can tell in a book, but just generally for democracy and citizens?
Well, I think extraordinary impact on our business and on politics, just the way it has, those things have had an impact on almost every aspect of our society. And people, you know, write doctoral dissertations about that. So I'll just say a few things. One is, it certainly has the potential, and sometimes does, prey on kind of the worst aspects of our media and our political media culture. Negative, partisan, too quick to reach judgments, superficial. All those things are things we had to fight before, and now every day, particularly with Twitter, there's a vehicle for people who want to manifest those horrible aspects of our lives to do just that. So I think there's a recognition, there was in the last campaign, and I think since, there's a recognition that we can't let these tools take over and dominate not just our output, but also kind of the ethos of what we do. But it's difficult because they do lend themselves to kind of the lowest and least of what we like to do in our profession and what politicians should be doing. I think it's clear that if you're on the right side of the digital divide, it's more information about campaigns available than there ever has been before. And as we write in the book, these things can have a huge impact. Part of why the president was perceived to have done so badly in the first debate in Denver against Mitt Romney is because Twitter decreed that that was the case about 15 minutes in, and the Obama people didn't realize that they had to fight back and kind of make it clear that that people shouldn't judge the entire debate based on the first 15 minutes. But in the future, people are going to learn that lesson and have to learn a lot more because it is an ever-changing thing, and it only brings us back to what the book's about for us, which is the human element. You can't let people's judgment and professional responsibility be overwhelmed by new technology, which again has the capacity to bring us down lower than we should be.
One last question. So please start coming up to ask questions if you want. One last question. How would you describe, well, let me ask you this question. Did Mitt Romney lose this election? Is that the narrative of this election more than Barack Obama won it? From all of the work you've done, from all the analysis, from all the aides, was this an election that was lost rather than one that was won?
Well, I think it's a little hard to exactly answer that in a clear way. I mean, that there's an exact answer. There are a lot of structural forces that were important, but there's no doubt that Barack Obama was a vulnerable incumbent. In the fall of 2011, we report in the book in a lot of detail about how at a time when the president had just come out of the debt ceiling crisis that summer, Democrats thought he was weak, Republicans thought he was weak, his approval rating was down at 39% or 40%, two-thirds of the country thought the country was on the wrong track, the unemployment rate was up over 8%, and growth was anemic. And there was no reason by any conventional metric of what it takes for an incumbent to get reelected, he was in trouble. And they knew he was in trouble, and they thought he was at best a 50-50 shot at getting reelected and possibly an underdog. So it was the case at that time that the right Republican candidate stood a reasonable chance of beating Barack Obama. A combination of things happened over the course of 2012, some of which have to do with Mitt Romney's flaws and foibles, some of which have to do with the president's skill, and some of which have to do with the modest improvement of the macroeconomic conditions in the country. The exact mixture of those things is impossible to disentangle, but they all played their parts. And, you know, if you had a Republican candidate who was able to do something Mitt Romney manifestly was not able to do, and you see this throughout the book, someone who could have fused the energy of the Tea Party and the populist right with the credibility and electability of a candidate who appealed to the establishment part of the Republican Party and the donor class, the millionaires and billionaires who funded so much of the Republican side, you could have seen a very formidable challenger in President Obama who would have given him a much, much, much tougher run for his money than Mitt Romney did. That much is certain.
Mark Halperin and John Halliman, the authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012. They spoke at the First Presbyterian Church on November 12, 2013, in an event sponsored by Town Hall. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of their talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Mark Halperin and John Halliman are the authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012. It's a behind-the-scenes look at our last presidential election. The authors spoke at the First Presbyterian Church on November 12, 2013, in an event sponsored by Town Hall.
Can I clarify two things before you start the Q&A? One is, as far as we're concerned, you guys can ask about whatever you want. You can ask about any topic, the details of the implementation of the president's health care law, or what John and I have learned about the details of the Clintons' marriage and writing the two books, whichever you prefer. All we ask is you restrict all your questions to the form of true-false. So just as you're thinking of things, if you could do that, that'd be great. Sorry, go ahead.
We'll start here. And I'll ask that you do ask questions, please.
A lot of reporters on television and newspapers that I quit reading, I did so because they're not really reporters, they're advocates of a point of view. So what's the point of reading or watching if you know what they're going to say? I never sensed that with you two, ever. So thank you. The question is, I have a friend who's covered the White House for more than 20 years, and I know her political preferences are more in tune with Mr. Obama than Mr. Romney. But she said she has never experienced a White House so obsessed with trying to control the news as this one. What would you say about that?
Thank you for that. I just get a quick sense of the audience because we're going to be delving here into some maybe sensitive issues for some of you. So I'm going to ask you all to vote by show of hands about who you voted for in the last election. If you're uncomfortable voting in front of the others, you can go ahead and close your eyes as you vote. Raise your hand if you voted for President Obama in the last election. All right. And raise your hand if you voted for Governor Romney. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right. Now, congratulations. By the standards of most Seattle crowds we talked to, you're a very diverse group. That's fantastic. Self-selecting, I know. So anyway, thank you all. And the brave six of you who raised your hands, if you need help getting out afterwards, let us know. This White House, the president promised to be most transparent ever. There's no doubt that they are awfully sensitive about leaks, awfully sensitive about controlling the message, in part as a reaction to some of the bad developments in our business and an attempt to try to keep the conversation at a higher plane. Now, I'm someone who, growing up, because my father worked in the Nixon administration, had my home phone wiretapped by Richard Nixon for 21 months. So is it as bad as that? Not as far as we know. But there is a clear consensus from reporters who've covered the White House over a period of time, like your friend, that this White House is certainly without equal, in the last few administrations at least, in being really concerned about those things. Part of it's national security. Part of it is this president is really anti-leak. So were his predecessors. But he has chosen to use some of the modern technology that we've seen implicated in other aspects of the balance between national security and civil liberties to be very aggressive about trying to shut it down. And I think it annoys reporters, but I think it also does have a chilling effect on the ability for us as a democracy to have a full discussion. So I'm not crazy about it as a reporter. I'm not crazy about it as a citizen. And I think it's incumbent upon people who do care about those issues, not just the press, to express a concern about that with members of Congress and with whoever puts themselves forward to be president the next time.
Do you find it strange that President Obama seems to know where you went to dinner last night every time you run into him? He always says, you know.
He's a very good guesser.
He always says, how did you enjoy Arby's last night, John? I'm always a little troubled by that. Over here.
Just to comment on the last question and on your answer to it. I think it's fair to say that the Obama administration is dealing with a Republican Party that exercises itself to the utmost to sabotage everything he does. Now my question. and further comment.
Question.
Okay.
I'll tell you what you can do. You can make a statement and then just put a little question mark at the end of it.
Or I can tell
a
him
trade what secret.
my question is, how valid is our presidential selection process in picking an able and competent person? We hear that the process is so arduous and difficult that only very capable people can survive that. We also now hear, especially from Republicans, that Obama is a very good campaigner, but very poor at governance. Where does all that come out?
That is not a true-false question, I'm afraid. So I kind of reject it on the merits. You know, I think that, boy, there's no question that there's a set of skills and a set of personal propensities that give themselves over to being a successful presidential candidate. And there's another set of skills that are required to run a successful presidential administration. There is some overlap between those two skill sets. They are not, the Venn diagram, though, is not identical. They don't, there's not a perfect overlap. Running for president is really hard, and running an administration is even harder. Certainly, I think President Obama, President Bush, and President Clinton, all extraordinarily gifted candidates, learned pretty quickly that their ability to navigate the gauntlet of getting elected was not the same as their ability to work with Congress, and even their ability to sell their policies to the American people. The biggest puzzle, it seems to me, about President Obama is not that he's found it hard to run the executive branch or deal with Republicans who, as you point out, have been extraordinarily intransigent, but that he himself would say, were he here, that his biggest problem has been his inability to sell his policies to the country when his communication skills as a candidate were extraordinarily powerful. And it turns out that even the skills that are involved, the political skills that are involved in communicating to the country as a candidate are not the, quite the same set of skills that are required, even the political skills that are required, just that are communication skills, are not the same as the ones that are required to muster support for policies that you hope to enact or that you have enacted. So there is, again, there is some overlap, tenacity and ability to control your public image. There's some overlap, but they are certainly not identical sets of skills.
Question over here.
So this isn't intrusive, true or false, but it might be yes or no. You guys said that you were able to write these books because you'd been around a long time and know everyone. But in this last election, the Republican primary field had so many fringe candidates that were from outside Washington, candidates that didn't have a big staff and really didn't like the mainstream media. I know you guys don't talk a lot about who you talk to, but was it harder for you to gather information with a Republican primary field that was like that?
I mean, it is true. You're right. There were some first-time candidates and people we didn't necessarily know for the 20 years we knew some others. But we start early and meet people early on. And again, we're not the only journalists who fit this description by any means. But if you've been around a long time, you develop a reputation, again, for taking your craft seriously and for treating sources with respect. That word gets around. And so we pretty quickly learned who we wanted to talk to and set out to make sure that they understood what we were doing and when necessary, gave people references from others. So you're right that there were some new people on the scene, and that presented a slightly different challenge. But by the end, as I suggested before, we had pretty extensive cooperation across the board, including from some of those newer people.
And even outsiders like Pina Coladas.
I'm going to go back over here. There's a few more people over here, then we'll be back over here. Question?
When the 47% comment came out in the media, what went on behind the scenes both in the Romney campaign and in the Obama campaign?
Oh, you'll be interested to read Double Down. I think you should go out and buy a copy right now, because there's a lot of really interesting material on that topic in there, I promise you. You asked before about resonant things in the book that were elements of high human drama, and I won't tell this story entirely either, but Governor Romney had committed this faux pas, said this thing, whether you believe it was a slip of the tongue or a misstatement or whether he was truly speaking his heart. He had said it months before, and one of the great lessons, if you read Double Down, is borne out by this story, which is he made this statement at a fundraiser in Florida when he was extraordinarily tired, and it turns out that really, like, one of the great keys to running for president is to try to get sleep, because the mistakes the candidates make when they're not well rested, they're littered throughout the pages of both of these books, Game Change and Double Down. When the thing broke, Governor Romney was very upset about it. Not at first. At first, he was more angry because he felt as though the comments he'd made were being taken out of context, and he was being unfairly maligned. He later got very upset about it and has a moment in the book where he is sort of up at 4 o'clock in the morning wondering whether this is the thing that will define him, and kind of thinking about, the things you least expect to define you may end up defining you. But really what's most telling about this story, and again, we go through it in a fair amount of detail,
what's going on in the interior of the campaign and what's going on in Mitt Romney's head. But the most amazing thing about it was that unlike many presidential nominees that we've covered and successful politicians we've covered, Governor Romney, for all his angst about it and for all his combinations of self-flagellation and rationalization about it, he really didn't do very much about it. He did not do what many other candidates would have done, which is say, guys, you know, this is a fatal problem for me. If we don't arrest and fix it, this could be it for me, and go out and give a big speech or do a dramatic interview or do something to try to clarify things. He more or less took a very passive, had a very passive response to it, which is something that you will see if you read the book, as I encourage you to do. You'll see throughout this kind of odd passivity that Romney has in the face of certain kinds of challenges. In the Obama campaign, I'll very quickly say, they expected him to apologize at the very outset, and they thought, you know, it'll be a problem, but he'll apologize and he'll move past it. The problem for Governor Romney was he had written a book once upon a time called No Apology, and it really comes up again and again in the book that he doesn't like apologizing because he would say, I can't apologize. I wrote this book called No Apology. And when he did not apologize, the president's team sort of thought, well, we're in pretty good shape here. That's good news for us.
We're going to want to get you guys back to sign some books. So we'll do five more minutes, try to move through as much of these questions as we can. Go ahead, sir.
We're told that the Romney team believed that they were going to win right up to the end. I'm interested in the public or the private polling. Are private pollsters scientific, reliable, objective, or is there a client bias that creeps into the work?
Poor pollsters, you can have some client bias, sometimes unconscious. In this case, Governor Romney had a really good pollster who just miscalculated, as did a lot of Republican pollsters, about what the electorate would be like. The president's team was very targeted on just those battleground states they knew would decide the election. And Governor Romney's team was confident because they said, well, we're going to win independence. No one's going to lose Ohio if they win independence in Ohio. But the president's team, with all their sophisticated understanding of the electorate and where the votes needed to come from, figured out a way to sort of change the electorate. So the poll's only as good as much as the pollster can determine what's the makeup going to be, who's going to turn out to vote. And they miscalculated and gave Governor Romney a pretty wrong impression about what would happen all the way up through Election Day, when he thought, based on the polling data, as well as his feel for the crowds he was building and the intensity there, he thought he was going to win.
Right here.
I just finished your books. I really enjoyed them. How did you separate, like, the gossip and the political axe grinding from actual, like, legitimate stories, even when it's intra-campaign?
This question comes up all the time, and you know, gossip by definition are things that are unverified. Everything that's in our book and in both of our books are things that we have reported within an inch of their lives and are things that we're confident enough that we put in the book, even though we write in the omniscient voice and we're going to get a lot of scrutiny. We put them in the book because we have come, using our normal reporting standards, come to the conclusion that they are in fact true. On the question of sources and their motivations, this is an interesting question. It comes up, you know, all the time, as I said a second ago, but it really is a question that journalists deal with every day. Every source that you ever deal with, in magazine journalism, broadcast journalism, newspaper journalism, or writing books, everyone you talk to has some reason for talking to you. Sometimes they have good motivations, sometimes they have bad motivations. Your job is to find out whether what they're telling you is true or not, regardless of why they're telling it to you. In the end, why they're telling you doesn't matter at all. All that really matters is whether or not what they're saying is actually what happened. And Mark and I spend an extraordinarily large amount of time and effort to make sure that the things that we're hearing are, which would clear away all the motivations that we might suspect, that the things that we're hearing are, in fact, what actually went down.
Right here.
Hi, great to have you guys here. I don't know if you know that Morning Joe is on at 3 a.m. over here, so it takes a lot of commitment to get you guys usually. Anyways,
for a lot of the people in the back, that would be on late as opposed to on early.
It is ironic to come back from the bar and watch you guys. And
there also is a device I'd like to make you aware of. It's called a digital video recorder.
No way.
They come with a lot of cable systems now. If you hit record, you can watch that thing anytime you want.
All right. I do like the hero and matter aspect of waking up at three. Anyways, with Chris Christie and this whole, is he going to run? Is he not going to run? Do you think, could you envisage a situation where Hillary Clinton and Chris Christie are the nominees and Democrats are kind of torn between the charismatic, straight talk of Chris Christie, who's not very liked by Republicans, it seems right now, and Hillary, who's the, I don't know, the establishment Washington politician. Do you see that there could be a, Democrats could have their heart torn apart in that situation? And how do you think it's going to...
I think it'd be fantastic for the other 48 states if the election were New York versus New Jersey. I think that'd just be... That would unite the nation, 48 against 2. They're different kind of politicians. I think that Chris Christie, and one of the things we learned in doing the book, because we both learned a ton about him that we didn't know, is he's incredibly gifted, and he's not afraid of anything. And that's a strength for most political situations, but not always. And I think that, if you think about the contest as both parties are going to get their base voters turned out, so who can encroach more on the other side's turf? I think you could make a case today that Chris Christie does have the possibility, as he's shown in New Jersey, to appeal to blue-collar Democrats and parents who care about education reform. And Hillary Clinton is more of a puzzle in the sense that in her career there have been at times when she has been extraordinarily bipartisan and has appealed to Republicans, for instance, when she was a senator, and at other times she's kind of been the number enemy number one of the right and would have a harder time crossing over. So I think that contest, if we had that contest, would be extraordinarily fascinating on the very dimension you're talking about. Who could appeal more to the other side? And I think, again, today, Governor Christie would have a claim on that potentially. She's been through a lot more at this level than he has. And I think until he proves, if he does run, that he can withstand the scrutiny and the slings and arrows that come with running for national office, he may never get to that stage. And for a first-time candidate, even one as talented as he is and as confident as he is, that may prove a much taller order than anything about appealing to voters on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I was surprised in the book that he doesn't come out looking that great. And I thought that was very interesting at this stage because he's gotten so much positive press generally. Were you guys surprised by that?
Yeah, we're easily surprised. We're by so many things. There's no question. Look, he's a very, as Marcia said, he's a compelling figure and also a complicated figure. I think you're referring mostly to the period where Governor Romney's team was vetting him to be a potential vice president, and they look at his record in New Jersey and discover that there are things there, none of which are smoking guns but there are a lot of issues that got some degree of coverage. They're in the public record, but really no one knows because he's not been, as Mark said, when you step on the national stage, you get a lot more scrutiny. There's a long litany of them in the book, but one that I've been giving a lot recently is this notion of Chris Christie was a lobbyist for a period of time. People generally don't know that he was a lobbyist, and that's one fact. And then the fact that when he was a lobbyist, he lobbied for something called the Securities Industry Association of America. And the SIA at that time was lobbying to exempt securities fraud from a New Jersey state consumer protection law. The guy who was the head of the SIA at that time was a guy named Bernie Madoff, who you may have heard of at some point. So for Governor Romney...
Just to be clear, not a different Bernie Madoff. Yeah. That Bernie Madoff.
Not Bernie L. Madoff as opposed to Bernie M. Madoff, but Bernie Madoff. And Governor Romney's team rightly sort of looked at that and thought, well, can you explain that? You might be able to explain it, but there's a 30-second ad here waiting to happen. Governor Romney's just picked us as a vice presidential candidate, Bernie Madoff's lobbyist. Is that fair? Well, sort of. It's kind of within the realm of politics, it's fair. There are a lot of things like that in his background. And then there was the fact that he agreed to be vetted as a vice presidential nominee and then more or less decided that there were things he didn't want to share with the team of lawyers and researchers who were looking into his background. Mark and I have never seen that happen before. Usually if you agree to go forward and be vetted, you then give over the material that they ask for. And there were a series of things they asked for more information from Chris Christie about, his other lobbying clients, his health records, a defamation lawsuit that was filed against him. His brother was involved in a securities scandal where he had paid a fine to the SEC. There was a whole bunch of stuff they wanted to know, and Chris Christie wasn't forthcoming to the extent that they expected. And so the combination of the things that were there that were kind of potential unexploded landmines and then these questions that had not been answered sufficiently led Governor Romney to that day when he looked at the final vetting report, which we quote from extensively in the book Double Down, which you can buy in a lot of different places, both in hardcover or electronic book, anywhere you want. We quote these things, and Governor Romney pulled the plug the next day. All of those things may add up to nothing, but there were a lot of things in the backgrounds of Bill Clinton, a little thing called Whitewater, and Barack Obama, a guy named Reverend Wright, and a DWI conviction and for George W. Bush, things that were out there, but and no one really paid attention until they were presidential candidates. And then they suddenly became big deals. And how Governor Christie deals with those questions matters almost as much as the questions themselves. And this gets then to the question of temperament, and you know we'll see how well he handles them. Some do really well. Others, and I, you know, you can think of a guy like Rudy Giuliani or a guy like Rick Perry, who were supposedly big deals, they didn't do so well once the spotlight was on them. So we'll see which category Chris Christie falls into.
Mark Halperin and John Halliman, the authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012. They spoke at the First Presbyterian Church on November 12, 2013, in an event sponsored by Town Hall. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of their talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.